Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, I wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license. Should I take another walk to the DMV? Get another learner's permit with a picture of me? I'd put it in my wallet along with my $4, and the condom that's still in there that is probably expired. I'd leave home for New York, but New York is where I'm from. I'm just looking for a way to feel my life has begun.
Hey, 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 how's it going? I'm Tammy, and you are tuned into Popular Education Radio here on Cable Community Radio. Yay! That was the artist, comic book illustrator, and musician Jeffrey Lewis with the song Seattle. Oh, one of my favorite songs. Yes, today I'm going to be interviewing Jeffrey Lewis, who's also going to be performing at the Fixin' 2 tomorrow night, Friday, November 8th. It was really great and inspiring interview that I had with him. We are talking about everything from music industry to DIY culture to American culture to even mentioned unions. And I'm so stoked to be able to broadcast this interview for y'all. Yeah, so without further ado, let me just go ahead and pop this bad boy on there. Like I said before, my name is Tammy, and this is Popular Education Radio.
For survival, and I guess I must be winning. And my story is so long I can't remember the beginning. Am I an optimist or am I a pessimist? If I see that half full, half empty cup is half full of nothingness.
Well, I make comic books and I make music, and the music is sort of sometimes on the folkier side of things and sometimes on the indie rock side of things. Yeah, I've been making comic books all my life also, so that kind of two things kind of mix together in certain ways.
In the comic books, they kind of describe your day-to-day life in New York, or like what inspires you for the comic books? Do they relate to the music itself?
I'm not really like an autobiographical or diary comic book maker. I'm kind of, you know, I try to do fiction, sometimes very strange fiction with certain reoccurring characters. And then other comics that I do are sort of, I guess you could say biographical. There's some stuff about my father's life. And then the illustrated songs that I do in concerts, I have certain songs that have accompanying illustrations where there's stuff about the history of communism is a topic that I'm really interested in. So I have, there's this illustrated series that sort of goes over the history of what were the underpinnings of the Vietnam War and things like that. So it's basically just whatever topics I feel interested or passionate about end up finding their way into the music or into the comics in some way or other.
I'm personally familiar with the Woody Guthrie comic. Can you tell me a little bit about that? How did you get involved with that?
Paul Buell does various comic book compilation projects, usually on political subjects or at least countercultural subjects. And he's contacted me to do comics for different books that he's worked on. And one project was a book called Bohemians, where different artists did different comic book narratives on the lives of people who are considered to be bohemians for one reason or another, whatever your definition of bohemian is. And so I did a comic book biography of Woody Guthrie for that book, but I wanted to do a sort of experimental method on it. And I tried this weird thing where I did like one panel for each year of his life. And it just created I thought that was an interesting narrative experiment, because the years that are considered the most important years of an artist's life, Woody was most active in the early 40s, say. But each one of those years wasn't given any more weight in the comic than, say, the year when he was 11 years old, and then the year when he was 12 years old. So I thought of it as sort of doing a biography with a steamroller, where the whole person's life is just kind of flattened out to this equal narrative weight. And the perspective that you have on a human's life from birth till death, when every year is taken as kind of a discrete period of time that's worth just as much as any other year, was a really, I really liked that, the way that came out. And I'd kind of like to do that sort of biography for other people at some point. I'd be curious how that plays out when I apply that method to something else.
If you had the chance to do one right now, who would you choose to do a biography on?
Maybe this is weird, but I was just thinking yesterday, I'm probably not going to do this, but I have ideas all the time. But I thought maybe a biography of Osama bin Laden would be really interesting. Who is this guy that we heard so much about? What did he do when he was a kid? How did he get involved in getting CIA money at a certain point and being, you know, kind of in the employ of the USA and then turning against? Like, it's a story that I guess in some ways what I'm very interested in is stories that you would never normally find in culture. I feel like culture is where we learn about stuff, but there's so much that's left out of American culture when you see TV shows and you see movies. For example, you almost never see anything that mentions a union. You know, I always think about this when you look at even working class TV shows, Roseanne or Cheers, or all these TV shows I grew up with as a kid in the 80s. These are supposed to be working class people, but they never, ever mention being part of a union or anything like that, which kind of creates a view of reality in which unions don't exist. And it could be up to an artist or somebody making a movie or somebody making a TV show to create a reality in which, hey, what if I was watching Die Hard and Bruce Willis talked about being in the policeman's union and how they were trying to get better benefits, not have to work such long hours or, you know, better health coverage for their kids or something like that. There's any number of ways in which you can tell a story and you decide what details to include and what to leave out. And our perception of reality is in a lot of ways based on, you know, what we're hearing in songs and what we're seeing in the culture around us. So I've always, since being a grown up, I've kind of gravitated towards, things that get me interested or things that I don't know about. And the reason I don't know about them is because they're not out there in culture. So I kind of feel like I should, sometimes engage in making some of those things, although that's not, it's not like I'm a political artist necessarily. There's just certain things that are interesting to me.
So would you say that you try to at least hold yourself accountable to do that?
Well, it's more, I think, finding what you're passionate about and what you're interested in. It's always so hard to like try to really put some kind of definition on what works artistically. Sex, for example, I feel like sex is everywhere in culture, and yet it's also kind of nowhere. Everybody, thinks that we're surrounded by sex and culture and music and movies, but there isn't really that much of a serious description of what, here the woman and the man get together at the end of the movie and it fades to black. Well, what exactly happened? Did they actually get along in bed? Like, what did they do? Did it work out the first few times? Did it take them a while to get comfortable with each other? Were they enjoying having sex with each other for a couple of weeks and then it wasn't working out as well? Like, there's just so much that could very well be part of what we're seeing in, songs and everything else. But these things are just sort of interesting to me. I'm like, what's behind that door? I just kind of follow my interests and then, the emotions that I write about in my songs or the events or the comics that I make, even if they're just very weird fictional things. If you make stuff, you just got to make stuff that you feel particularly interested in. And it's not like I have such a big following. I mean, here we are in Kent. We played a show in Kent last night and there were about 70 people in the room. So it's, we're not talking hundreds or thousands of people. It's on a pretty humble level. Everywhere we go, there are some people that want to come see these shows and check out what it is I'm doing with my band, and that's great. And we just keep on running around and hoping that people are continuing to be interested.
The Misfits are cult rock and roll, worshipped by a few but ignored on the whole. Meet the Feebles is a
film cult classic. It's basically unknown, but some say it's fantastic. Most women that I meet seem totally unfazed, till sometimes there's somebody who seems totally amazed. I might not be in magazines as a heartthrob face, but in a few devoted hearts I've found a strong fan base. I'm a cult boyfriend, not a mainstream show. I'm lonely or I'm worshipped by a lady in the know. When you're a cult boyfriend, life is always intense. They love me or they hate me, no one's on the fence. Cerebus is a cult comic book series. It's got fans, but it's never found in movies or in theories. WFMU is a cult radio station, always tuned to by a few devoted fans around the nation. For every time I couldn't get a second date or even first, why does one think I'm the best when all the rest think I'm the worst? All of those times no one at all wanted to know. If I'm really all that awesome, wouldn't more people think so? I guess cult boyfriend is the term for me. It's always been quality, not quantity. A cult boyfriend's like a record in a bargain bin. No one knows its worth till a collector comes in. Some cult literary names I can honor. Maybe J.G. Ballard or Flannery O'Connor. Haggis, Fugu, that's like food for cult eaters. Jim Jones, Charles Manson, Father Yod, they're cult leaders. Anyway, the point being, do I have to be magical? Can't we date a few months, then move on, normal and casual? Suicidally alone and then totally smothered. It's so much pressure when you go from one extreme to the other. I guess cult boyfriend is the term for me. It's always been quality, not quantity. A cult boyfriend's like a record in a bargain bin. No one knows its worth till a collector comes in. I'm a cult boyfriend, not a mainstream show. I'm lonely or I'm worshipped by a lady in the know. When you're a cult boyfriend, life is always intense. They're in love or they're indifferent, no one's on the fence. This song probably ain't gonna go very far beyond an open mic. It's guaranteed, though, two or three people are really gonna like it.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to Popular Education Radio. I'm your host, Tammy. That song was Cult Boyfriend by Jeffrey Lewis. And tonight I'm going to be playing my interview with Jeffrey Lewis. We just heard about his comics, a little bit about his perspective on American culture and himself. Next up, we got so much more, diving into the music industry and the DIY movement before and after the internet and how it's affected it. And also speak on one of my favorite bands, Crass, and Jeffrey's cover album that he did called 12 Crass Songs. Really great stuff. One of my favorite parts about the interview is how Jeffrey was not shy about voicing his opinion on what's wrong with the music industry and kind of painting me a picture of what it's like or what it was like and what it is now. If you'd like to give me a shout, you can do that on the Instagram at Popular Education Radio. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or just want to say, hey, Tammy, you're doing a marvelous job, email me, populareducationradio@gmail.com. So without further ado, here's the rest of my interview with Mr. Jeffrey Lewis. Would you say that you're like a cult band, or would you say you're an anti-folk band, or what? How would you describe yourself?
Well, I was, you know, primarily interested in, like, indie rock was sort of a big influence on me starting to make music. Daniel Johnston was basically my biggest influence, the idea that you could just make a song without having all this extra stuff around it in terms of, you know, you could just make a simple recording. You didn't have to have fancy equipment or anything like that. So that directness really appealed to me because you could just kind of get it done. Stuff like Sebado or Yo La Tengo, obviously the Velvet Underground, and the Violent Femmes. These were all kind of influences on me and my brother Jack when we started making music together in the late 90s. And when I started playing at this place, The Sidewalk, in New York City, that was sort of an open mic night, and you could also get gigs there. They had this thing going on there that they called the anti-folk scene. And then when I started playing shows there and hanging out there, everybody was like, oh, you're part of the anti-folk scene. And I was like, well, I guess I am. So it's kind of a cool, weird name, anti-folk. I don't know, you know, it's obscure enough that you don't get pigeonholed because nobody really knows what it means. So I guess it's better than saying that you play, indie rock or jazz or bebop or something, because people know what those things mean. And at least Amplifolk has managed to avoid definition by being so obscure and unpopular that it doesn't really, people hear that word and they're like, oh, I don't really know what that is. So I guess that's good.
Really like to get your opinion about Crass, but also why did you decide to do the 12 Crass songs?
I've been really enjoying Steve Ignorant's new record. Filmmaker Jeff Swearzig turned me on to it, and I bought it from Bandcamp, and I've listened to it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really very good. It almost sounds like sort of like television personalities or something. It doesn't sound like Crass, but it's mm-hmm. passion, and I recommend it. Crass is obviously, at least in my opinion, one of the great bands of all time. Just incredible songs, incredible originality, the lyrics, the music, the whole approach is just jaw-dropping. I mean, I think there's millions of bands in the world, but there's a very tiny fraction of them that, you know, have an impact and, you know, have an impact for decades, where I think you could still play Crass mm-hmm. for somebody today, you know, decades after it came out, and it would just be, somebody would just be floored, like, what is this? You know, to the extent that it's potentially life-changing. I mean, you hear something like that, and it's the power of art. I mean, it's just, there's like nothing else like Crass in the world of music. And those first three Crass records particularly, Feeding of the 5,000, Stations of the Crass, and Penis Envy, when I got into those, I was just really knocked out by them. And I covered a couple of Crass songs in concert at different times. And then at a certain point, I just had this idea, like, well, why don't I just record an album of Crass covers, but sort of do them in my own style, where you could really hear what the songs were and what they were about. Because the original Crass recordings, although they're kind of unbeatable in their own way, they are very dense and very hard, especially as a first-time listener, to figure out what all those great lyrics are. They're kind of just clustered in this very dense and very abrasive way. But this was also at a time in the early 2000s when it seemed to me like indie rock had become very easy listening, where a lot of the bands and albums that were super popular in the early 90s, well, the stuff that I was into was like a little more abrasive, I guess, like Archers of Loaf or, even like Stereolab or Pavement or, mm-hmm. you know, of course, The Fall, bands like that that had more of an edge to them. Whereas by the time I was putting out records in the early 2000s, it seemed as though indie rock and alternative music had really turned into this kind of light, easy listening, easily digestible stuff. The most popular things, even though, you know, I think they're great albums too, but the most popular things in the indie rock world at that time were like Sufjan Stevens and Devendra Banhart and Belle and Sebastian. These are like very easy listening compared to Crass, shall we say. Because at that point I was known as a kind of lo-fi, crappy sounding artist for making these homemade sort of rough edge recordings. And I thought, well, okay, if the world wants some kind of pleasant to listen to, nicely produced studio recordings, why don't I try making a record like that? But the songs will actually be Crass songs. So it was sort of like a Trojan horse thing to like make these very nice recordings where people wouldn't even necessarily realize at first if it was playing in a cafe or it was playing somewhere. It might take a few minutes for somebody to notice, wait a minute, like these are all Crass songs. And to kind of get that Crass message slipped into the current music culture that was going on at that time in the early mid-2000s. And it was also just a great learning experience for me because I had never really produced songs before. My own material was so stripped down. I had never really thought about approaching a song and thinking, well, what if I put a piano on it? What if I play some percussion on this? Or, you know, whatever, you know, just to kind of think about the sound more in a way that I hadn't. That was another part of it for me.
How did you pick which songs to put on the album or which songs to perform?
I guess some of them I could quite easily put out another album of Crass covers and maybe even another one. There's quite a lot of good Crass songs. And there were a number of songs that I sort of messed with that didn't end up making it onto the album that I released. Certain ones just kind of leapt out at me as they just suggested a certain melodic approach, or they were just, it was just kind of easy to pick up an acoustic guitar and start playing them as regular 3 or 4 chord songs, translating them from the shattered and angry crass versions, mm-hmm. just sitting on my bed, like with the lyrics in front of me. Certain ones just made perfect sense, played acoustic. And then other ones I sort of tried that didn't necessarily work, or there were just too many words, or there was just something lacking about, you know, once you subtracted the attitude from it, maybe there wasn't an, but I don't know. Like I say, I could easily record another 20 Crass songs. The ones that I picked were, you know, some of them were my favorite Crass songs. There were certain ones like Systematic Death or I Ain't Sick, It's Just a Trick, or Walls, that for me stand out in the Crass catalog is just some of their absolute highlights.
Big A, little A, bouncing B. The cat's in the cupboard, but it can't catch me. Big A, little A, bouncing B. The cat's in the cupboard, but it can't catch me.
External
Big
control,
A,
are you gonna let them get you? Do you want to be a prisoner in the boundaries they set you? You
Big
say you want to be yourself.
A,
do you think they'll
B.
let you?
The cat's
They're
in
out
the
to
cupboard,
get you.
But it can't catch me.
Be exactly who you want to be. Do what you want to do. I am he and she is she, but you're the only you. No one else has got your eyes, can see the things you see. It's up to you to change your life, and my life's up to me.
Be exactly who you want to be. Do what you want to do. I'm he and she is she, but you're the only you. No one else has got your eyes, can see the things you see. It's up to you to change your life, and my life's up to me.
Hello, 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 this is the Lord God, can you hear? Hellfire and damnation's what I've got for you down there. On earth I have ambassadors, archbishop, vicar, pope. We'll want you with more ability, you'd best abandon hope. We're telling you, you better pray, cause you were born in sin. Right from the start we'll build a cell, and then we'll lock you in. We sit in holy judgment, condemning those that stray. We offer our forgiveness, but first we'll make you pay.
Hello, 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 now here's a message from your queen. As figurehead of the status quo, I set the social scene. I'm most concerned about my people, I want to give them peace. So I'm making sure they stay in line with my army and police. My prisons and my mental homes have ever opened doors for those amongst my subjects who dare to ask for more. Unruliness and disrespect are things I can't allow. So I'll see the peasants grovel if they refuse to bow.
Palaces for kings and queens, mansions for the rich, protection for the wealthy, defense and privilege. They've heard the ropes in Ireland, engaged in civil war, fighting for the ruling classes in their battle against the poor. Around every other corner stands 1984. Guardian of the future, they will implement the law. He's there as a grim reminder that no matter what you do, Big Brother's system's always there with his beady eyes on you. From God to local police, in home and street and school, they've got your name and number, while you've just got their rule. We've got to look for methods to undermine these powers. If time to change the tables, the future must be ours. Be exactly who you want to be, do what you want to do. I'm he and she is she, but you're the only you. No one else has got your eyes, can see the things you see. It's up to you to change your life, and my life's up to me. The problems that you suffer through are problems that you make. The journey you have to climb through is the shit you choose to take. If you don't like the life you live, change it now, it's yours. Nothing has effects if you don't recognize the cause. If the program's not the one you want, get up and turn off the set. It's only you that can decide what life you're gonna get. If you don't like religion, you can be the antichrist. If you're tired of politics, you can be an anarchist. But no one ever takes shirts by pulling down steeple. Systems aren't big bricks, they're mostly made of people.
Without your walls, I am alive. Without your walls, I am alive. Without your walls, I am alive. Without your walls, I am alive.
Now where to breathe inside your walls? Left to dream inside your walls. Left us in a wilderness. Well, I can make my paradise. Without your walls, I am alive. Nobody, I am rank and file. Girl and boy and man and wife. Flesh you measure with a smile. Have and hold and hold and have. Have and hold and hold and have. Desire deny, deny desire. Have a child to justify. Images that you apply. I won't bow my head in shame. I won't bow my head in shame. I won't play the game the same. Without your walls, I am alive. Without your walls, we all survive. Without your walls, no guilt to bear. Without your love, I love to share.
Without your walls, I am alive. Without your walls, I am alive. Without your walls, I am alive. Without your walls, I am alive.
With a smile, hold and hold and have. Desire, deny, deny, desire. Have the child to justify.
Try and get
the that you
like
require.
When you're having a problem, yeah, it sounds shitty when you
have a problem.
Without
your walls, I am alive. Without your walls, we all survive. Without your walls, no guilt to bear. Without your love, I love to share.
Without your walls, I am alive. Without your walls, I am alive. Without your walls, I am alive. Without your walls, I am alive.
Scientific data.
Some of the best music ever created was by Crass and later on Jeffrey Lewis when Jeffrey Lewis decided to cover Crass songs. My name is Tammy and you're tuned into KBOO Community Radio. This program is called Popular Education Radio and I'm interviewing Jeffrey Lewis, musician, comic book illustrator, guitarist, overall just really cool dude. Coming up in the interview, Jeffrey Lewis is going to share his thoughts about the music industry, and it's really interesting how it's evolved from the 90s to now, and even more so how we consume music and how we go about it. You know, it's different. Even as artists, the way that they are putting music out is just completely different than it was like 10, 20, 30 years ago. So, you know, without further ado, here's the rest of the interview. I'm Tammy. This is Popular Education Radio. Enjoy. And in your music, you don't just perform alone. You've worked with different people or different bands, different groups, both, or, you know, for the Crass album or 12 Crass songs and for all your other music. Why don't you have like one band that you stick with? Do you like it better this way? Do you like performing solo? Like what's your deal? What's the deal with that?
Well, it's kind of just pragmatic. My brother Jack, who played bass with me from when I first started out, he moved out to Portland, Oregon a bunch of years ago. So that made playing together and touring together a little more difficult. And I started working with more musicians in New York City. My drummer, Dave Beauchamp, who had drummed with me for about 8 years, moved to England. So that became obviously more difficult. The level that I'm at, if we play to 100 people, that's a relatively big show for us. We're not a big band. So it's asking a lot of musicians to be part of this kind of project. Mm. You know, we're driving ourselves, we're staying at people's houses. There's nothing glamorous about this level of artistic life. And there's not even any, it's not as though we are on our way up and coming towards the big time. This is just what I do, and it's what I've been doing. So anybody that's going, you know, sort of coming along for the ride with me in the band, they have to know that they're going to be carrying equipment with me, and bass player, maybe somebody else who might be playing keyboard with me. Somebody might come along and have a great time being in the band for a couple of years, but, you know, people have husbands and wives and dogs and cats and kids and maybe other things they want to do with their life other than play Jeffrey Lewis songs forever. But I try to pay everybody some kind of fair wage, and everybody's free to make and sell their own merchandise at the gigs and keep all the money for the things that they sell. So the bass player and the drummer usually make t-shirts for the band. There's an interplay, and there's a kind of a shared little enterprise between the band members and the people that I'm with currently, Brent Cole on drums and Mem Paul on bass and keyboard. This has been a pretty solid lineup for about 4 years now, and we've toured all over the world together. And my brother Jack still joins us for certain shows, so once in a while we'll tour as a four-piece with Jack joining us, and then most currently it's the trio between me and Brent and Mem.
That sounds like such a beautiful collective that you have there. And how has the internet changed in, like, social media? Like, obviously I'm guessing it made it easier for you, but, like, is it like a significant change since when you started?
I think I was lucky to have started just at the time where that had kind of already just happened. When things were first starting to be officially released on Rough Trade Records, and I was first touring in Europe, there was all this, like, infrastructure left over from the old days. Because this was, you know, my first official CD came out in 2001. So the internet had really already happened. And all these sort of rock clubs and these people that had these jobs to be a tour manager or a driver or, you know, these record label people, I think they were still operating on this, like, old method. And I had to kind of fight quite a bit to shake free of that stuff and tell them, you know, I know how to drive. We don't need you to send somebody out to drive us. We don't need all this extra infrastructure, because where's that money going to come from? You know, the old style of the record industry, as far as I understand it, was like, there was just somehow all this extra money from record sales. And I entered the music industry kind of just when that was over. So I never had any illusion that there was going to be all this money from record sales. I just went into it thinking, well, look, we can just do this ourselves without having to pay for all this extra help. And if what we do is good and gets people actually like what it is that we're doing, then there's going to be people coming to shows and there's going to be people buying my records and my comic books, and that can keep the whole thing going along as long as we don't have all this extra expensive interference. And the internet, of course, allowed that to happen too, because, like I was saying in that book, Our Band Could Be Your Life, about bands that are touring in the 80s, they had a much harder time doing things themselves. They were able to get it done, but the amount of phone calls and postcards and calling from payphones in the street, the whole DIY independent music thing is greatly helped by the internet, because my ability to book concerts, my ability to book flights, my ability to look on a map and see how long is the drive from the club in Detroit to where we're sleeping in Michigan City, or just having all of this technology kind of makes the independent music life more possible. Of course, it's hard to say whether maybe we'd be making more money if it was like the old days and there was more music stores and people had to actually buy a record in order to hear it. We kind of almost can't conceive of a reality in which somebody has to buy it in order to hear it. That's decades old already. But, you know, I just put a new record out. It just came out yesterday. It's out on CD. It's out on LP. It's available digitally. And the record label's been telling me for 10 years. They keep saying physical media is totally dead. Nobody buys CDs. But I haven't found that to be true, because I always do a lot of artwork in my albums. I always try to make some kind of interesting packaging. And my fans know that if they're just listening to it online, they're missing some element of it, because I've usually got some kind of interesting packaging design, and whether it's some kind of fold-out thing or something that happens with the package. So it's all, I don't know, everything's always in flux. It's not like It's not like Spotify and Pandora are going to be there forever. It's just the way it is for this couple of years, and then something else will come along. But, you know, if the art is good, if there's something strong and interesting about what an artist is making, then you can kind of float on the ever morphing ocean of the technological means of how that reaches people. Mm-hmm. Whether it's reaching people because of you running around playing gigs, or whether it's reaching people through streaming, or whether it's reaching people on a CD or a tape or a record.
There's always good old radio, too.
Yeah, radio, which has transformed tremendously from the internet. I mean, podcasts, but it's not like any of these things are now the way that it is. This is just the way that it is at this minute.
Now, yeah.
Last couple of years, it's going to be a different way next year, and a different way again the year after that. And meanwhile, I still have to write. I still have to sit down with a blank piece of paper and write something on it that turns into a really good song. And I don't know, nothing. Technology can't help that. It's just, you know, somehow art needs to get made.
That old store, my regular spot. Sometimes I go there, other times not. It's been there so long, that's just the way that it is. I don't wanna think that it could go out of biz. I don't wanna go there, cause it might be the last time. I just want it to be there if I happen to pass by. That's what makes it good, that's what makes it okay. When I don't have to work or stress to just make it stay. I don't want it to be there, cause I fought or demanded. I just wanna love it and to take it for granted. Never felt charming and it always felt unfair. Then we met at a concert or a party or somewhere. Soon I don't know whose house is where my gray hooded shirt is. Cause I guess that we're dating or whatever the word is. And I'm glad when we're eating and discussing our plans. I know already we'll be hanging out next week in advance. That's what makes us relaxed, that's what makes it a life. When you don't have to worry about these things every night. It's not a very good fire if it just stays when you fanned it. What's the point if we can't just take each other for granted? This apartment that could turn into ash. I've got backups and copies that could all burn and crash. I've got this old car, but it could fly off the road. I've got these two eyeballs, but they both might explode. I've got all my limbs, but will I have them forever? I've got fingers here that any random door hinge could sever. But the building that's standing shuns the bricks it stood up with. And the family still living are the ones to put up with. Cause you can put down a blanket anywhere on this planet, but you'll become very anxious unless you take it for granted. The world is so fragile, every moment's enchanted. But it's all a sad battle if I can't take it for granted. I just want to love it and to take it for granted. Back when I was 4 and I knew the name of every dinosaur, I learned how to read ROM comic books. My babysitter said I was really smart. When the lights went out, everything changed. The radio music made me feel strange. And I had a real bad dream about a gorilla in the bathroom. And back when I was 6, I took everything real serious. And I thought that every song that came on the radio was referring to strange sexual acts, because they thought I wouldn't know the facts. And being small is hard, and no one ever tells you how. And back when I was 8, I would sit outside on an old milk crate and look out at the world from the stoop across the street. The boom boxes and the hot concrete, and every Halloween they hung a million rubber skeletons across 9th Street. And back when I was 12 or so, I swear to God I never felt so low. Everyone but me was making out and eating cookies. I had more than my brain could stand. I threw my life in a garbage can. I felt so weird I had to disappear and crying suicide disease. And at 15 getting stoned felt good and sent me back to childhood. Had nothing ever mattered to me more than that. But then 16 became eclipsed, my brain became apocalypse. I was lost and found and I've never been the same. And back when I was 22, I left the best thing that I knew, and I gave it up for fortune and for fame. I played like I didn't know how, I shocked the world, I wowed the crowd, but I deserved more than what they gave. And
back when I was 27. Still nothing had been forgiven. Clay turns into rock and rock just sits. So sitting on a crowded beach, I'd pretend I was a leech, and I'd stick to things here and there for a little bit. And back when I was 31, I knew I'd become what I'd become. Nothing left to reveal, and there was nowhere else to turn. So shocked and withered, dumb and bitter, and in need of a babysitter, I'd gladly let my hand fall off and burn, burn, burn. Back when I turned the big 4-0, I realized just how much there was to go. And I started to think being alone forever wasn't where it was at. So I took my head out of the window and taught myself how to love real fast. I started talking about painting with a woman in the laundromat. And back when I was 50 and my first wife had just left me, I felt okay and I sang my daughter funny little songs. And just when I thought the best was past, I fell in love for real at last. And it didn't even matter that it had taken me so long. And back when I was 63, the public rediscovered me. My comic books and albums had all become rare cult collector items. And both my parents were deceased, so they didn't see my records get re-released. And I got a dog for the first time in my life. And back when I was 74, my dog died and I got two more. I still felt really good about my daughter and also about my girlfriend. And I would sing and draw a little bit, but mostly I would just wake up early and sit and hang out with the puppies and wish that I could live forever. And back when I was 87 and my grandson had just turned 11, my woman was dead and my dogs were getting pretty old. My body didn't work quite like it should, but overall things were pretty good. I was getting decent royalties from the reissued comic books and records. And back when I was 106, my only friend was one goldfish. Everyone I ever knew was dead and gone. And the goldfish never had a name. And the neighbors thought I was insane. And I flushed it down the toilet when I saw it floating upside down. And back when I was 128, I'd sit outside on an old milk crate and look out at the world from the stoop across the street. The boomboxes and the hot concrete, and every Halloween they hung a million rubber skeletons across 9th Street. Every Halloween they hung a million rubber skeletons. Every Halloween they hung a million rubber skeletons. Every Halloween they hung a million rubber skeletons.
Boom. My name is Tammy, and this is Popular Education Radio. Our time is just about over, but I'm going to play the rest of my interview with Jeffrey Lewis, who's going to be at the Fixin' 2 November 8th. Don't forget, don't be late. It's a date.
Yeah, I've never played the Fixin' 2 before. I've played a lot of different venues in Portland, but this one's new for me. I think there's actually only about 30 tickets left to that show, so get them while you can. Friday, November 8th at the Fixin' 2 in Portland.
Awesome. And are you going to be playing new stuff? Are you going to be playing stuff off the old albums? What should we expect?
Well, I expect the unexpected. I'm always a big fan of bands like Yola Tengo and the Grateful Dead, who would play completely different set lists every night and always surprise the audience. So I always wanted to be that kind of band. So at this point in my career, I have about 100 songs that I can pick from. Old songs, new songs, works in progress. Maybe cover songs that we like throwing in for fun, the illustrated songs, and it's kind of just my daily ritual in the car. If I'm not driving, I'll sort of look through our whole song list, and I'll start picking what might be an interesting thing to start the show with tonight, and then what could be interesting to play after that.
And are you going to have some artwork, that recent artwork, or do you have anything that's recently published?
Well, unfortunately, I don't have my new comic book. It's not quite finished. It's almost finished, but I just wasn't able to finish it before the tour started. But I do have 12 other comic books that I'll have with me, and a couple of posters, including the poster that I did of the complete works of David Berman. That was a project I did with him a few months ago. That I did this for the band The Fall also, where it's like a poster where I've got 112 Fall songs kind of illustrated into the poster. That's just sort of a fun side project. I was thinking I might maybe I should do one for Sonic Youth next or something.
Ooh.
It's just kind of, you know, for fans of that band, they can kind of look and pick out what all the different songs in the poster are. So I've got some of that stuff with me. And, you know, I've got the new record. I've got a bunch of older albums and CDs throughout, you know, just sort of a selection through the career. So when leaving the house to go on tour, it's always like, what stuff should I take with me? And just taking a mix of different things.
Awesome. That should be exciting. So I know I've taken up a lot of your time, and I really, really appreciate it. Last question. If you had any advice to give to upcoming artists or musicians, what would it be?
Well, I guess everybody's path is a bit different, but I've always been a really strong believer in just the value of the work itself. The artwork itself is what comes first, and that's something that I learned from Daniel Johnston and that I continue to learn over and over again, that, you know, none of the rest of it matters. If there's five people at the show, if there's 50 people, 500, 5,000 people, you know, if you walk away from the show with $5 or walk away from the show with $5,000, none of that matters compared to the actual song. I mean, is the song important to you? And can you sit down with an instrument and a piece of paper or a computer or whatever your method is and make something that feels really powerful to you? And if you can do that, then maybe it'll feel powerful to some other people out there too. But money can't buy it. You can't spend more money on fancier equipment, fancier amplifiers, and get better songs. That doesn't work that way. It's just, you know, a human being and what they're able to create. And that's kind of the fuel at the heart that generates everything else. And nothing else really matters compared to that. So I'm always, you know, I advocate for playing open mics a lot. I think that's a really good way to see, to just test out the stuff that you're doing. I play open mics every time I have new songs. I always try to find an open mic to play to see what it's actually like to play this new song live.
You still play it now? Like,
yeah, I mean, wow. Anytime I have new songs, I'll go to an open mic in New York City and try it out on stage. I might just be reading the lyrics off of a lyric sheet if I haven't got it memorized yet. Just that constant process of just making stuff and hoping that you make something that feels good to you. And a lot of times it doesn't happen. I mean, I make a lot of stuff that I don't think is worth holding on to. I've got, you know, tons of songs that I might have played once or twice and then just felt like, doesn't really do it for me. And, you know, drawing in sketchbooks is like that too. Just, you know, if you just draw and draw, you'll get better. You'll get better at what it is you're trying to do. And money can't buy it. You know, you can't buy being a better artist. You just do it. And the more you do it, the more you'll sort of learn what it is you're doing.
It went well. You didn't have to do it all yourself.
Hey. Oh, that was so enlightening, wasn't it? That was just so nice. It's always pleasant when you speak with someone that inspires you, or when you meet someone who inspires you and they aren't rude or mean or fake or not about that life, you know what I mean? It's really just so refreshing. That was my interview with Mr. Jeffrey Lewis. I keep calling him Mr. Jeffrey Lewis, and I think that Jeffrey Lewis is going to find that kind of funny or annoying. I don't know. Again, thank you so much, Mr. Jeffrey Lewis, for allowing me to interview you. And for fans or people who just want to check him out, he's going to be at the Fixin' 2 tomorrow night. That's Friday night, November 8th. And I'm going to be there. So, you know, you can always say, hey, Tammy, I heard you on Popular Education Radio, on KBO Community Radio. And I just wanted to say, hey, because I'd really appreciate it. If you have any question, comments, concern, feel free to hit me up. Instagram at Popular Education Radio, or the good old email Gmail, populareducationradio@gmail.com. Next week, I'm actually going to be sharing my interview with Steve Ignorant from the band Crass. So yeah, if there is a theme that you're sensing, then it's because you're right. It's going to be just so many great things. A lot of education, music education, history education, political education. Ah, so much information. And yeah, thank you so much for tuning in. Like I said, my name is Tammy. This is Popular Education. And remember,
popular education is a form of freedom.